Okay, good evening. Thanks for coming out virtually in person. Today is Yom HaZikaron. Just wanted the learning should be a merit to all those who gave their lives defending Eretz Yisrael, being in Eretz Yisrael, being killed because they were Jews. It's really that is what the dying El Kiddush Hashem is. And, you know, they express our gratitude for the protection of us, and the learning should be in their merit. So last time we crossed about, we're going from Har Sinai, probably close to 2,000 years of history from Har Sinai to the period of the Talmud. And tonight we'll do a little bit less than that, but it will be a couple hundred years, but I want to focus on the Rambam. He is someone who's become such an important figure in really all areas of Judaism, in halacha, in machshava, in Jewish thought. Again, there were some things that were controversial at the time. There are some things that he held that are not necessarily unanimously held, but for the most part, has left an incredible impact and was really an incredible person. So I want to focus on the Rambam and how he fit into this chain of tradition, what he did for halacha, and then also a little bit what some of the controversies were about his work, as well as some of his more philosophical ideas. You know, the challenge with this topic, and as I said last time, I'm very excited about it, is to do justice to the different themes that we're talking about, but you know, do it within one class. So we'll try our best. So really continuing from where we left off last time. So last time the takeaway was that the Talmud Bavli was unanimously accepted, and it is absolutely authoritative as far as any halakhic decisions that would happen subsequent to it. Again, even within the Talmud, there are debates, and there are many times where the Talmud itself doesn't say which sage we rule like. So there could still be differences of opinion as far as what position we take, as well as the details of that law. But after the sealing of the Talmud, so you can't have even the greatest scholar have a position or interpretation that's contrary to anything that's found in the Talmud. And that's where the rabbi picks up in his introduction to Mishneh Torah, which is his code of law. So he gives the history, some of we saw last time, that the Talmud was sealed. But afterwards, after the sealing of the Talmud, okay. So if any, then no scholar could interpret the halacha in a novel way. And anyone who comes with an explanation that contradicts what's found in the Talmud, that interpretation would be rejected because the Talmud was unanimously accepted. Shalom, I will put the link to the sheet in the chat. Okay. But then what happens after the Talmud? So the Rambam says that I actually have it as a continuation. So but this is really where we left off, a little bit of review from last time, that the Talmud is authoritative. Then what happens in the period after the Talmud? So again, these are several hundred years. You can probably get a PhD, you get PhDs at every stage of this. There's a lot to discuss. So we're gonna only brush over some of what happened at the time, though it is important. But right after the period of the Talmud was the period of the Savaroyim, and they lasted about 90 years after the Talmud, and they had academies basically in the locations that the great academies of the Talmud, Pumbedisa, Sura, in Babylonia. Then afterwards, there was the period of the Gaonim. A Gaon is literally a genius, but they were in that time, the position of the Gaon was an official position. You know, it's like a Rosh Hashiva, a rabbi. I mean, the position was a Gaon, and there are very famous figures who are known, Hai Gaon, Shvira Gaon, Sadia Gaon, that they were officially the heads of the academy. And they were also, it was at that time a more centralized position. So even though it didn't have the same absolute acceptance that the Talmud had, because the Rambam says later on, but explains that after the time of the Talmud, the dispersion became even greater, and there wasn't really the ability to secure that unanimous approval. But at that point, it was the Gaonim were almost universally accepted. Then after the period of the Gaonim, so that's roughly until, let's say 1050. And we'll see when we get to Gaonim, the Rishonim, the earlier authorities, and the Achronim, the later authorities, there's not necessarily an official date where it was, okay, I've conned the Rishonim, the Rishonim are gone. But people say roughly this is the period of the Rishonim, this is the period of the Gaonim. So when we come to the period of the Rishonim, or the earlier authorities, and the general dividing line between Rishonim and Achronim is basically the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch is the mid-1500s. And that's basically, when you talk about Achronim, it's more or less those who are working with the Shulchan Aruch. Exactly. Rishonim are those who came prior to it. So one of the first major Rishonim, and the first one who really codified Halacha, was the Rib. I was going to bring show and tell. But basically, if you look at any... in the back of standard Hebrew Gemaras, so you'll find the Rif, Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi. The Rif was from Spain, and he did something which no one else had done before, and he wanted to basically give people the bottom line halakha. You have all the discussions in the Talmud, and probably up until then, not everyone knew the entire Talmud and how it was ruled, but there was a central authority. And probably if you had any questions, you would be told, or it was known what people did. But then what the Rif did was he took the Gemara with all the discussion. And in the back, you'll see that he basically just puts the bottom line. So let's say there is a dispute, Rav and Shmuel. So we'll quote the part that says Rav says this, if the halacha is like Rav. And that, from as far as I'm aware, didn't really cause much controversy, because it kept the structure of the Talmud, and made it a little bit easier for the masses, or probably in this case, really for people who were scholarly enough to be studying Talmud, but gave a reference for what the bottom line halacha was. But this probably wasn't as controversial, at least we'll see, not as controversial as what the Rambam's Mishnah Torah was, is because it still kept the format of the Talmud. You could still see the connection between the Talmud and the what we call the Rif, but the basically his halachic conclusions without the back and forth. And the Rif was very authoritative, and basically every halachic work since then has incorporated the Rif. If you look in your standard Gemaras on the Rif, there's the Ran, there are other commentaries on the Rif. You have to analyze why the Rif comes to the conclusions he did. So that's the Rif. So basically smooth sailing until then. Then you get to the Rambam. So because focusing on the Rambam, we'll give a little bit of biographical information. And one of the things I love about preparing these classes is to get to learn a little bit more about each of these figures. And for the most part, you realize that they had lasting power for a reason, that they were extraordinarily impressive people. So the Rambam was born in 1138 in Cordoba, in Andalusia. Andalusia is in southern Spain, which was under the rule of the Almohads, the basically Muslim religious society. And he had significant training in halacha, but also in philosophy and in the sciences of the time. In fact, he wrote his first treatise on philosophy when he was 16 years old. So at the time, he was getting a well-rounded education. And I didn't know until recently they're basically three primary works that the Rambam, that are associated with the Rambam. There's the Perush HaMishnayos, his commentary on the Mishnah. There's the Mora Devuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, the philosophical work, and the Mishnah Torah. So Mishnah Torah is this halachic work. And the first two were actually written in Judeo-Arabic by the Rambam himself.
Which one was the Rambam on the Mishnah, and then the Mishnah Torah?
The Perush HaMishnayos. Okay. So the Perush HaMishnayos and the Mora Nevuchim, the Guide for the Perplexed, were originally written in Judeo-Arabic. They've become standard translations. The Mishnah Torah was written in Hebrew. Mishnah Torah is halachic work. And we'll see that the Rambam is presenting his work, that the idea is that this will be the bottom line from then on. There won't need to be argument or discussion, but there probably been more people and more conversations about the Rambam than anyone else. So it shows, you know, the best laid plans don't always work out the way we envisioned. And part of the reason why many are so precise with the Rambam is the Rambam wrote Mishnah Torah in Hebrew because he wanted to be, and he was very, very precise with the wordings that he used. Which is why people make, you know, diukim. They closely analyze and scrutinize the words of the Rambam because you assume, especially in Mishnah Torah, if he used a certain word or omitted something or added something, it was very, very precise. So, but the Rambam, he wrote his Perush HaMishnayos, which is a commentary on all of the six orders of the Mishnah when he was 23. Not only was he 23, but in the conclusion to his commentary on the Mishnah, this is under number four, we have the Rambam on the second page. So he apologizes to the reader. He said that, if anyone has any questions about what I wrote, you're probably right, because I was basically on the run. I didn't have, my mind wasn't totally at ease. So if you have any questions on or any challenges to what I wrote, you probably have a point. So when you see his humility, too, you see that he wrote this when he was 23, while he was running from the Muslim powers that be in Cordoba. And after that, he fled to around northern Africa. He went to Fez, in Morocco, then also experienced persecution in Morocco as well. And generally, we assume that the situation under Muslim rule in the Golden Age was better than a Christian Europe, and probably was, but it doesn't mean that it was so great. It was bad enough where his family had to keep on moving. And in Morocco, the Jews were faced with the option of either death or conversion to Islam. And the Rambam's family then went to Eretz Yisrael for about a year, and then they settled all together in Egypt in 1166. And the Rambam passed away in 1204. So basically the last almost 40 years of his life were in Egypt. That's where most of his career was. And in 1171, when he was 33, so he's appointed the Rais al-Yahud, I'm sure how to say the Arabic, which is the official head of the Jewish community. And that required the approval of both the Muslim government and the Jewish community. So he became, at a young age, clearly prodigious and clearly had training in different areas and the ability to really rise in society. But in this position, so he was able to focus more or less exclusively on Torah, and that's where during the period that he wrote his Mishnah Torah, his halachic work, because his brother managed the family business. But then his brother died at sea in the Indian Ocean, and there's a letter from the Rambam where he really laments the death of his brother, and at that point he had to support himself. But he didn't want to take payment for his rabbinic post, and in fact, in his commentary to Pirkei Avos, maybe we'll see it in a coming Shabbos, he castigates some of the later Gaonim who he felt were used, the Mishnah Pirkei Avos says you shouldn't use as the Torah as a plow to you know, to cause harm with or to damage with. You shouldn't use the Torah for your advantage. And the Rambam in his Perush Mishnayos there does make reference to, you know, some of the officials in the higher ups in the Jewish community felt were requiring people to pay, you know, to pay taxes to them and to financially support that. So he was very opposed to that. And it shows, you know, he was 23 years old. So you can imagine that was probably the first controversy that he entered. So what happened when the Rambam went to work? So he apparently had some medical training, at least the training in the type of medicine that whatever was available at the time. And he became the chief physician in Cairo. So then his schedule was busy. And in one of his letters, he writes about his daily schedule. He says, "I'll tell you that I've become known as a physician among the mighty, such as the chief judge, the emirs, the house of Al-Fidal, and the other princes of the land, those who lack nothing. But as for the masses, I'm beyond their reach, and they have no way to approach me. And this causes me to spend the entire day in Cairo tending to the sick. And when I get back to Fustat, all I can do for the rest of the day and into the night is examine the medical texts that I need to consult. As a result, I do not have a moment to study Torah except on the Sabbath. And as for the other sciences, I don't have a moment to study any of them. And this harms me greatly." So he already wrote the Mishnah Torah, but this is obviously he used his time on Shabbos very well. Probably also fit in time to learn, but you see that he was very busy. Okay, so that's a little bit about the Rambam, just who he was, where he came from, the kind of world that he lived. So now to his Mishnah Torah. We're calling it the Journey Through Jewish Law. So we'll focus primarily on the Jewish law aspect. So the Rambam's contribution to Jewish law, which has basically become a work that all the codes that came after, at least after a certain point, were based on and incorporated as Mishnah Torah. So in the continuation of the introduction, which we saw before in number 5, so he says that even though the rulings of the Talmud can't be disputed, it's the final authority, but there's confusion about what exactly the correct rulings of the Talmud are. And it also includes the Rishalmi, at least with areas that the Babli didn't address, and the Halachic Midrashim, the Tosefta, which is Brisos, sections of oral law that weren't included in the Mishnah by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. So because of that, it's confusing. People don't necessarily have guidance on how to behave. So he says, "Therefore, I've girded my loins, I, Moshe, the son of Maimon," right, who mentioned, but his father was Maimon, Moshe ben Maimon, Rambam, or Maimonides. So he says he contemplated all of these texts and sought to compose a work which would include conclusions derived from all these texts, the forbidden, the permitted, the impure, the pure. And he did it in order that the oral law should be organized in each person's mouth, he says, without questions or objections. And he says, so you'll see what he says, and you can imagine if someone were to say this today. So at least you think, so, okay, someone was controversial in their time, we're not really sure why, but if you see what he writes, it's pretty easy to see why he may have rubbed people the wrong way. So he says, "From now on, instead of arguments, this one claiming such and such and another such and such, now this text will allow for clear and correct statements based on the judgments that results from all of these texts and the explanations." It says, "From the days of Rabbeinu HaKadosh, from Yehuda HaNasi," and so this will make it possible for people of all levels of learning, he'll be able to know what to do with regard to every single mitzvah. So he says, "Klal shel davar," this is on page 4, to summarize, "they should lo yehi adam sarek lechibor acher va'olam b'din medina Yisrael." So he writes the Mishnah Torah so that a person won't need to consult another text with regard to any Jewish law. So if we were to stop there, okay, maybe he's just saying that this is going to be the authoritative text for bottom line rulings. But not only that, Eliyahu Fibor Zeh, this compilation includes the entire oral law from the times of Moshe Rabbeinu, all of those and all of those laws that are ruled in the Talmud. And that's why he called it the text Mishneh Torah. Why do you think of the name Mishneh Torah? Literally, the second to the Torah. Because what would be the plan of the course of study once the Mishneh Torah came out, or at least as the Rambam thought? So a person would still need to know Torah Shevachsav, the written Torah, and then forget about Mishnah, forget about Gemara. Then you just jump to the Mishneh Torah. And you have everything you need to know there. And I thought that this would be the, you know, final authority. And what he did was different than what the Rif did, because the Rambam doesn't go in the order of the Talmud. In fact, if you just go in the order of the Talmud, it would be hard to necessarily look things up. We have the Masechta's name, Brachos, Shabbos, Erevin, but there are laws that apply through other topics that are not in that Masechta. You know, the bracha to make on a certain type of beer is found in Bava Basra. Meaning, the names of the Masechta are a general indication of what the themes are, but it doesn't mean that any halacha you want to learn and you want to look up is going to be in the Masechta. So what the Rambam did is he made different volumes. He has different, basically 14 books of his Mishneh Torah. So you have to say for Mada of knowledge, Zmanim of different times of the year, my Sakrabanos, Kachim, you have different Kedusha, you have different sections. And within that, there are topic headings. There is, you know, the laws of Shabbos, laws of Yontif, laws of Karban Pesach. It makes it pretty easy to look something up. And because it's organized so well, so a person can look something up and they don't need to go through all the trouble and all the confusion of learning through the Talmud and all of the different positions and arguments. They can just go from the oral law to the Mishneh Torah. Now, I don't know if that's really what he meant, that no one would be learning Talmud anymore. But he does seem to be saying that at least as far as bottom line halacha, it does seem like he was de-emphasizing the need to learn Talmud. That was one objection, which I think is a very powerful objection, is even if he were to say that these are the bottom line rulings, it doesn't necessarily give you the whole understanding of the topic if you don't know the Gemara behind it. You know, you can look something up in, you know, the Shulchan Aruch, maybe see the bottom line ruling, but certainly if you want to rule on cases that are not exactly those that are found in, at least in the Rambam's time, the Mishneh Torah, in our time, the Shulchan Aruch, you need to know, you know, every posek, they don't just, but yes, they know Shulchan Aruch with all his commentaries. They also know all of Shas because you need to know the analysis and you need to know what are the different factors and aspects of the topic. But it does seem to be saying that at least for the layperson, it just does get, say, layperson and scholar alike, that you could jump from the written Torah and anybody you want to know what to do, you don't really need to bother yourselves with the Mishnah and the Talmud. You can go straight to the Mishneh Torah. He says it's like a second Torah, second giving of the Torah. So you can understand why many of the Rambam's contemporaries weren't so happy with this idea. And the Ravid, Rav Avram ben David, or Ibn Daud, the Ravad, or commonly called the Ravid, so he has the Hasagos, he has his critical comments on the Mishneh Torah, on the Rambam's work. And his comments are published in every edition of the Mishneh Torah. So you see the Rambam and his, and those who argued with him have come together. And in every Mishneh Torah, there are different ones with some have more commentary, some have less. But I think in any edition that you look in, you'll have the Asagos HaRaim on the side. And basically, it's nowadays you can't really learn the Rambam or get insight into into the Rambam's position without also seeing what the Ravid commented on. So all throughout Mishnah Torah, the Ravid tends to disagree with the Rambam, not for the sake of disagreeing. There are things that they agree on. But from page one, it's kind of interesting that the Ravid then continued to comment on basically everything else the Rambam wrote in Mishnah Torah. Because on page one, it doesn't sound like he likes the idea so much. He says that the Rambam in number six, he's abandoned the method of all the authors who preceded him, because they brought proofs for their word and cited their sources. But this way, I don't know why I should disregard my tradition and my proof for the sake of this author's book. Meaning, who's to say? I mean, we're not going to say, but the book is recently published. So one, I'm supposed to give up the Talmudic analysis of the topic. And number two, I just have to accept his conclusions wholesale. Why can I look to other scholars or other teachers? So even though the writer continued to comment on basically everything else the Rambam wrote in Mishnah Torah, he seems to have his first objection to the work itself. It happens to be later on their writings from the Rambam where he acknowledges that. He acknowledges that that's a weakness of the Mishnah Torah, is that it doesn't cite sources. I think he was going to get around to it, and he didn't. Though also published in your standard editions of the Rambam is the Kesef Mishnah, which was written by Rabbi Yosef Karo, who is the author of the Shulchan Aruch. And in addition to some comments, he'll basically write where in the Gemara the Rambam's position is found. So other people subsequent to the Rambam did that work. But he didn't cite sources, but you also see his humility that he does recognize that was something that was a shortcoming. And so that was to the Mishnah Torah itself, the objections to the Mishnah Torah itself. The Rambam wrote it so that people wouldn't have to learn Talmud, and it provides the bottom line rulings. It's an organized structure, but the Rambam wasn't the only one who we have a record of as disagreeing with the whole idea of the Mishnah Torah. Other people, but basically along the same lines, is, were you just going to give up the whole analysis, and why should we just accept your rulings, especially because you're not providing you're not showing your work. So it's not so clear that the ruling should just be accepted. So it was a criticism of the Rambam's Mishnah Torah itself. And probably the more famous controversy surrounding the Rambam, once you get past the objections to the work itself, to his Mishnah Torah itself, are some of his ideas. And we can talk a lot about it because many of the controversies took place shortly after he died. The Ravid was in his lifetime, but then there's a famous attack on the Rambam by Rabbeinu Yonah. We'll see that's how that story is developed is very interesting, very powerful. But then that happened about 100 years after the Rambam, after he lived. So, but just go through some of the more prominent objection to the Rambam's, some of the Rambam's ideas. So Asher and I have been learning the Mor Nevuchim, the first part. It goes through every single way of saying that any references to God as being physical are not to be taken literally, and any belief in God as physical, having any physical parts, being constrained by any types of physicality, which the Rambam says is by definition, physicality is by definition a constraint because you're subject to your environment and your surroundings. But the Rambam goes as far as saying that someone who believes in, or someone who understands, let's say, the biblical passages that speak of God having, you know, an arm, literally, so they're a heretic. Let's say you believe in God, you believe in Torah Mesinai, you believe in all of that, but you take literally when it says Yad Chazak of Israel Nitzuya, or Etzba Hashem, the finger of God, or a strong hand and an outstretched arm. The Rambam says that if someone takes that literally, understands that literally, they are a heretic, similar to someone who doesn't believe in God. So the Ravid, while not disagreeing that the statements aren't meant to be taken literally, but he objects that, you know, not every mistaken belief is heresy. Heresy basically means you deny something very fundamental. And so the Ravid in his critiques to the Mishnah Torah in number 8, he says, why does he call this person a min, a heretic? Many great people who are greater, I can't even say this, so the Ravid, Kama Gedolim Betovim Imenu, that many people who were greater than he followed this opinion. And whether maybe they didn't believe in it, but certainly didn't make such a big deal out of it. I think it's understood the Ravid was not saying that it's an acceptable belief to understand these biblical passages as meaning that God is actually physical. But just the Rambam spent so much time objecting to this idea, like it's on par with not believing in God or not believing that God gave the Torah. And one of the criticisms of the Ravid is just that he grouped that as heresy. This may be among the more famous objections that the Ravid has to an idea of the Rambam, which probably led the Rambam later on to write a work about Tfiyas HaMeisim, the resurrection of the dead, is the Rambam says that in Olam Haba, he writes in Hilchos Teshuva, Ein Bo Guf, the Gevia, there's no body or physical form, Ela Nachos HaTzadikim Bilvad, Belo Guf Kemalachei HaSharis. Rather, there are only the souls of the righteous without a body, like the ministering angels. I'm actually not sure why the Rambam's position was so subject to misinterpretation or confusion, because later on the Rambam does have an interesting distinction between, and we sometimes use it interchangeably, though it's not so simple. The Rambam has a position, the Ramban has another understanding, Olam Haba, Gan Eden, Tchias HaMeisim, Yemosim Mashiach, the world to come, the Garden of Eden, the resurrection of the dead. Sometimes we use this interchangeably. We may say Olam Haba, some context is understood to mean in the times of Mashiach, when there's Tchias HaMeisim. The Rambam distinguishes between these. And here he uses Olam Haba, though it's understood, at least the way the Rambam is clarified, is that what it sounds like, the accusation was that if we were to understand Olam Haba is referring to the ultimate world, the final point of existence, well, the Rambam is saying that there's not going to be any physicality. There's not going to be any physical body. But clear from it's at least allusions in Pesukim, the Gemara and the end of Sanhedrin goes through a lot of proofs in the source for Tchias HaMeisim, the idea that there will be a resurrection found in the Torah and in Tanakh itself. But it's clear that that's a mandated belief, that there will eventually be a resurrection of the dead in the physical bodies. But because of this, it was subject to some interpretation. And you could say more about it because it does seem to be the same language as the Gemara. But the way the Rambam is understood is there are two stages. At first, when people die now, so they'll go to Olam Haba, which is where the bodies are separate, where the souls are separated from the body. Then in the times of Mashiach, those souls will come down and will come back to life. Will be reunited with the physical bodies. And the Rambam does hold that then after the resurrection, people will live very long lives, tranquil lives, but then they will go return to this Olam Haba, this non-physical existence. Others assume, no, there will be everlasting life everlasting physical life in after Tchias HaMeisim, using why the Rambam holds that you come down to this world, but then to go up. But that is the position of the Rambam. There will be Tchias HaMeisim, people will live very long lives, but then we'll go to that ultimate stage of the soul being separated from the body. But it's clear that he believes in Tchias HaMeisim, but others understood this as maybe the Rambam is saying there is no physical resurrection of the dead. And how do we say that? If we quote the Gemara Ksubas that in the future, the tzaddikim, the righteous, will shamdu bilvusheyan, they'll rise up in their garments. There will be a physical resurrection of the dead. So that was one point of confusion. But again, in the Rambam's humility, he then wrote a piece about Pius Amesim, clarifying his position. And in the animamims, which are based on the Rambam's principles of faith, the last principle is Tchias HaMesim, is that there will be a resurrection. But that was one point that was subject to criticism, at least how the Rambam phrased it. And then there was a more general objection, and this was true during the Rambam's lifetime, it was true afterwards, in the century or two that followed, but even to some extent till nowadays, and particularly in some of the Hasidic leaders, Reb Nachman of Breslov and others, did de-emphasize or advised against really delving into the Rambam's philosophy. I don't think it was that it was illegitimate, but there was some, the criticism of the Rambam's use of philosophy, use of Aristotelian philosophy in particular, there was objection to that. But the objection was very, very strong in the time of the Rambam and in the period that followed. One of the most famous opponents, at least at one point of the Rambam, is Rabbeinu Yonah. Rabbeinu Yonah from Gironde, from northern Spain. He gathered support against the Rambam and was able to enact a formal cherem, a formal ban on the study of the books. And he wasn't enough to ban or discourage the study of the Rambam's works, but the Rambam's works were actually publicly burned. Rabbeinu Yonah ordered that the Rambam's philosophical works, so this was basically the Mor Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, and the Sefer HaMada, the first part of Mishnah Torah, he arranged that the Rambam's works should be burned. That is, we'll see what happened, but though also in the Rambam's time and a little bit afterwards, the Rambam had defenders. One of his big defenders was the Radak, who was based in France. He was one of the Chachmei Tzarfat, one of the French Rishonim, and his approach in many ways is similar to the Rambam, what we classify as more of a rational approach, supposed to a mystical approach, at least when interpreting psukim verses. And he wrote letters to the Spanish leaders that they should revoke the ban of the Rambam, that they took it too far. So the Radak was one of the defenders of the Rambam, David Timchi, lived 1160 to 1235. He's famous for his commentary on Tanakh. And then one of the main defenders, but also the main critics of the Rambam, and we have records of both of them, is the Ramban, Nachmanides. So much of what Nachmanides writes, whether it's on Chumash or on philosophy, is arguing with the Ramban. And in general, on the page 5, number 12, and in general, the Ramban takes a more mystical approach. Much of his commentary is based on Kabbalah, and the mystical traditions that were available at the time. And there are significant differences. At the same time, the Ramban was also publicly defended the Rambam. While disagreeing with much of his approach, much of his interpretations, and his general approach of embracing philosophy, but he's saying, you know, basically it's in number 12, in a collection of the Kisvei Ramban, a collection of writings of the Ramban. He's saying basically, you know, the Rambam is Kiru. He lived in a different society. We who live in northern Spain and Eretz Yisrael, who are part of the more mystical tradition, we don't need this. And right, and we disagree with that. We believe that some of his interpretations of certain passages non-literally, you know, are not correct, and the Zemor Nevuchim, his philosophical work, can lead to much confusion. So we disagree with that. That's not our style. But he says he built a sanctuary for the masses, the unlearned masses who go up into the breaches. How many dispersed of faith has he gathered? To how many hungry for wisdom is his bread given, his water sure? How many atheists and perverts who have put our Talmud to shame has he answered correctly? So he's saying it's not our style, but the Rambam lived in a different part of the world, in a different society, and he was responding to the challenges that arose and were present in the society in which he lived. So there was a little bit of a compromise with the Rambam. Is he wanted, I guess this is always how a good ambassador or middleman works, is you can't, sometimes you can't get people to reverse their position entirely, but he tried to get them to modify it. Instead, when it came to the Mori Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, which was the main work that was attacked by Rabbeinu Yonah and others, he said that, let's revise the ban to just have a ban on studying it publicly. Because you study it publicly, then the people who are less learned will get involved and be subject to misinterpretation. But it's someone who wants to study it alone. They really shouldn't do it, but we're not going to put a ban on that. So that was the Ramban's position. They have to be Rabbeinu Yonah's cousin. However, Rabbeinu Yonah is that at one point was not willing to budge, and he said had arranged for the Rambam's philosophical works to be burned. Now, that's pretty severe. One, to burn words of Torah, to burn a scholar's work, but especially in times where there wasn't the printing press, it was really a statement when you burnt a book. That was really a showing that it was completely unacceptable. But then is the question how much of this is verified. But what definitely is verified is that it's clear that at a certain point, Rabbeinu Yonah reversed his position on the Rambam. From the fact, and see this in Pirkei Avos, so Rabbeinu Yonah has one of the more famous commentaries on Pirkei Avos, quotes the Rambam all the time. Constantly quotes the Rambam. And the history, the tradition is that when the Talmud was publicly burned in Paris, the Christians put the Talmud on trial. They determined that it contained heretical information. So when the Talmud was burned in Paris in 1242, there was something like 24 wagon loads of manuscripts that were burned. There were Rishonim, there were commentaries at the time that we lost. And you should say Kinos about that. And so it was a terrible thing for the entire Jewish community. And Rabbeinu Yonah understood that as perhaps being a consequence of going too far with banning the Rambam's works and ordering that they be burned. That as a consequence for him arranging for the Rambam's works to be burnt, so the Jewish community was punished by having all these manuscripts of the Talmud burnt. So he viewed that terrible event as a sign that there was measure for measure for what he did to the Rambam. And there's a tradition that Rabbeinu Yonah's work, Shari Tshuva, a work all about Tshuva, was to his way of kind of making amends for what he did as project to make amends for what he did to the Rambam. Well, this shows the intellectual honesty that he most of the time people, when they have a strong position, especially if they have a strong position, they'll maintain that they're right, even if they're not sure that they're right, but they have to maintain their position. Here he's willing to take certain things as a sign that he should reverse course. And the tradition has it that he wanted to go and he lived later than the Rambam, so he made it his mission to go and travel from Spain to Eretz Yisrael and bury where the Rambam is buried, to beseech him for forgiveness at his grave. And the tradition is that he died before he made it, died of some illness before he was able to make it to Eretz Yisrael to ask forgiveness from the Rambam. But it's clear that he reversed his course with the Rambam from his, at very least, his commentary on Pirkei Avos is constantly quoting the Rambam. So that was some of the objections to the Rambam. One, the Rambam's contribution, major contribution to halacha, at least, is the Mishnah Torah organizing halacha, being providing the bottom line conclusion. But what about the Rambam's vision itself? Was what he envisioned, did that turn out the way he had hoped? He writes that from now on, we'll have the written Torah and we'll have the Mishnah Torah. We'll just be able to look up halacha. We won't have the need for all of these discussions. So I don't think that happened. And there is an irony that the Rambam is one of the most argued about works and commented on works. So if you think this is going to be the final thing, no one has to argue or be confused anymore. So it didn't really work out. However, the Rambam, while not accepted in with everything that he wrote or every position he had, was something that I hear from the introduction to Beis Yosef, from Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, which did become really the authoritative work. The Rambam is, say, one of the three amudim, one of the three pillars that, unless Rav Yosef Karo was unable to find a two out of three system, his method was, how do you determine what the ruling was? Take the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush, and so you had two out of three ruled one way, he would rule that way. It was basically his methodology. But the Rambam became a major pillar in the halakhic process and left a tremendous impact on halakha, made a tremendous made his contribution. And we see things don't always work out the way we plan. Things aren't always the way they are at the time. Sometimes it takes a little while for ideas to become accepted. And as we see, the Rambam wanted to do a service to the community by providing bottom line rulings without any argument. He didn't get that, but he was certainly installed into the essential canon of Torah study. And in the areas of philosophy, in the areas of halakha, in the areas of learning Mishnah and others, the Rambam really left a very, very important impact in some way that any student of Torah comes across, and it plays a major part. So we learned a little bit about the Rambam, what he was dealing with, what his goals were, and why he was so important, but also why he met some controversy. Okay, we have 1 minute till Mincha. All right, have a good night, everyone.